God, sometimes I feel so inadequate to convey the truth about you. I don't want to talk religion. I don't want to do what's acceptable just because we as men in our culture in this time find it acceptable. But I thank you that you're not a dad that just abandons, takes us out and dumps us somewhere and leaves us. I thank you that your grace is enough. Not your unmerited favor towards us is enough. And I thank you that we can depend on that. I thank you that we can, if we're willing, we can turn our eyes on the Lordship of Jesus and purposely focus on who He is and what He is and what you are and who you are. And that the things of this world can grow dim and not be the thing that control and dominate and determine. So, God, please expand our boxes today. I would like to say tear them down and get rid of them. That would be a wondrous thing. And if possible, do that, but at least kick a side out, please. Please push us to realize that our view of you and our is at absolutely best extremely minimal in light of who you are, in light of your glory, in light of your holiness, in light of the richness of your character and the fullness of who you are. So God, please push us for your name's sake. Amen. So we're in finish up 22. I first started reading this a couple months ago, Second Samuel 22. I said last week, I'm not a Shakespeare guy, and I'm not really a poetry guy. You know, it doesn't. I'm a romantic, but poetry just doesn't get it done for me. I'm not. Say it what it says. Yes, you are my poetry. So. The more I read it and the more I thought about it and what did David say and what was he saying and what was he singing, and you know, it was interesting to me that it was a sweet thing to realize that this is also recorded in Psalms, in Psalm 16, and it put to music for the choir to sing for the services in the temple. Pretty sweet deal. So it was, you know, God preserved it for a big reason. It wasn't just David's little talk. It was something that, God preserves for all time for us to learn from and see. And last week we read through the first half of it or so. And, you know, something over the period of time reading this, that's kind of stood out to me is that, you know, I just want to counter it briefly before we move on to the second half. And there's a mentality that's so prevalent in our culture that we're pretty arrogant in our understanding of science and our, you know, our dissecting of molecules and atoms and thinking that we're pretty stinking in our the fact that we have fancy phones, we're pretty smart. You know, we tend to look at people and say, well, lightning, and they said, oh, that was from God, and thunder, oh, that was God speaking, and we go, Well, they were just ignorant, right? They were just dumb people. And you know, it talks about the wind. I mean, you know, the word for spirit is wind. It's, you know, and it's that's God's description of the Spirit of God is wind. And we tend to look at those things and when they talk about them in the Old Testament and they talk about thunder or earthquakes or I want to be careful to come against that. Because that's foolish. What aspect of God's creation does he not have authority over? You know, what aspect of the wind or thunder or lightning or clouds or rain or the molecular structure of any living organism, which part of that is God not in authority over and able to control and determine? And I would say that we have become the very ignorant ones that have failed to see the authority and the power of God in the things that he's made. You know, it isn't, there's a big difference in worshiping the world and worshiping, quote, Mother Nature. I mean, that's from the pit of hell. But worshiping the creator of nature is absolutely correct and right. You know, I mean, the truth is, we should be in awe and wonder. I mean, God holds life in place. You know, there is really not a lot of reason when you break it down to its finest little dust componentry why we are any different than that chair you sit on and why that chair is even holding you up. I mean, that's the truth of it. And yet God holds that power. He holds that molecular, the way that atoms work and the molecules work and there is no wind that ever blows that God is not aware of, that God is not determined. There is not a wildflower that blossoms that God does not have his hand in creating. And so when they talk about these things and we stand back and go, hey, you guys are kind of stupid to think that, to describe things this way because you really didn't understand science. We are really the foolish ones when we allow that to pervade in us or to taint our thinking. God put things in order and, you know, the way the clouds work and the way the world spins and the way that gravity functions and the way the universe is held together and the way that we rotate in our solar system and the way the planets are held there. Who designed that? I mean, who put that in place? And who empowers it to continue? You know? I mean, if you thought for a moment, we don't understand why atoms do what they do and circle around in this little energy form and go around in little circles, spin around in little nucleus and protons and neutrons and all this stuff. We don't really understand. We're pretty proud of ourselves thinking that we see these things and look at them and know them and understand them. What if God decides, you know what? I think I'll shut down that energy. I mean, we would all just go, right? I mean, just melt into the same blob and mess. You know, for us to, so it's changed my perception in the last couple of weeks and reading this. And when David's talking about God and God saving him and God coming there, there really is a higher understanding, not a lower understanding, not a foolish understanding, that he sees the hand of God in the power that God has put in nature, in the force of the wind, in the force of the constantness of the ocean, and gravity, and the way things are held together. And it would be foolish for us not to appreciate that and to respect that. So I'm gonna read the first part again, basically read through it again and I would encourage you to, all of us, that when we look at it, you know, yeah, we can, you know, we had third grade science that gives us an understanding of lightning bolts or something, or rain clouds and how they form and what happens there. But we shouldn't remain 8 years old and ignorant in our understanding of the authority and the power of God, that He is the Creator, that He did create that, and that God does function through what He has made. You know, it's a pretty important thing. You know, I love winter, as you know, and you know, and I there's a side of me that the snow's going away, and I'm a little sad. You know, I love winter. You know, I love the fact that God made snow to reflect light. You know, I mean, it's frigid and cold, but this winter was such a spectacular display of God making snow white in little crystals that reflect light. I mean, just think if He made it gray, you know, or blue even, or, you know, red or black or whatever, you know, it would be pretty ugly. I mean, it would be pretty dark and dingy, but man, He made it white and He made it reflect light. And I love it, you know, as I see the last of the snow going away on the hills and, you know, green grass coming up next to this snow cornice that's still blown over. And I love it. You know, God thought about it and was purposeful and displays His power and His authority in the things that He's made. What He says, for the wrath of God, I was just looking in Romans again, for the wrath of God is revealed against all mankind because they refuse to acknowledge His God. God is God. For His divine nature and eternal power are seen through what He has made. So men are without excuse. Romans 1. You know, and I would contend that goes beyond just, oh, let's go look at a tree and see if I see God. Okay? It goes beyond that. But the authority and the power of God is seen in the dynamic of, you know, as spring comes on and the animals start giving birth, and the animals don't act like we do as humans, but as we as fathers are, God has called us, and this is inevitable within human nature. Either we fail terribly, or we succeed on some level based on the level that we as fathers replicate the character and nature of God. Period. We don't replicate the nature and character of God. God has called us to do that. God has put that within us. God has structured things accordingly. And as a father, to the degree we replicate that correctly, the character and nature of God, we succeed and our children succeed and we prosper. To the degree we don't, we fail and our children are tragically impacted because of it. That God has implanted that in nature from day one and put that there. Then David spoke to the Lord, the words, 2 Samuel 22, the words of this song, on the day when the Lord had delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. And he said, the Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, the God of my strength in whom I will trust, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold and my refuge, my Savior. You save me from violence. I will call upon the Lord who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be saved from my enemies. When the waves of death surrounded me, the floods of ungodliness made me afraid. The sorrows of Sheol surrounded me. The snares of death confronted me. In my distress, I called upon the Lord and cried out to my God, and He heard my voice from the temple, and my cry entered His ears. Then the earth shook and trembled, and the foundations of heaven quaked and were shaken because He was angry. Smoke went up from His nostrils and devouring fire from His mouth. Coals were kindled by it. He bowed the heavens also and came down with darkness under His feet. He rode upon the cherub and flew, and He was seen upon the wings of the wind. He made darkness canopies around Him, dark waters and thick clouds of the skies. From the brightness before Him, coals of fire were kindled. The Lord thundered from heaven, and the Most High uttered His voice. He sent out arrows and scattered them, lightning bolts, and He vanquished them. Then the channels of the sea were seen, the foundation of the world uncovered, and at the rebuke of the Lord, at the blast of the breath of His nostrils. I would encourage you all, man, the next time a storm happens, go out and think about it. You know, next time there's a lightning storm, next time there's thunder, next time there's clouds billowing and rolling, realize that the hand of God is there. You know, and one of the great tragedies that we have is we have this pathetic, soft view of who God is. You know, it's talking about Him being our defender and our warrior and our strength and going before us. And you say, well, that was his David because he was kind of a warrior kind of guy. Really? You know, that there's a passage in Exodus 15. My wife and I were talking about this morning. Her sister wrote music to this passage, and it's actually one of my favorite songs. It's one we should probably learn. It's a sweet, sweet song that she wrote music to. But this is back. Remember, Exodus 15 is where God had called His people out of Exodus, out of Egypt. Okay. He called them to leave Egypt and put Moses there, and obviously had done some pretty wild stuff. Pestilence and storms and hailstorms and stuff, you know, turn the river blood red and epidemics of frogs. And, you know, we can all look at that and go, well, this is a scientific, whatever. God purposely enacted these things in order for the people to finally say, enough, enough, this God is too powerful, let's let these people go. And then God, I was looking at a map again this morning of it, doing it, you know, here's this place in Egypt, you're looking at it from this side, you know, Egypt is here, you know, at the mouth, you know, coming in where all the colluvial comes down, all the water comes together, and all this flooding happens and stuff, and it's a pretty rich place, richest place on earth. And they had Israelites by the millions as their slaves that were building the pyramids and building these great sphinxes and building all these things for them as slaves. And God had put them in slavery for 400 years. And then God called them out of that, just like, you know, there was generations obviously born in that and born into slavery, right? And God called him out. And here, where's the promised land? You know, he'd given Abraham the promised land initially, but they really hadn't taken a land. You know, they hadn't done what God had told them to, hadn't taken a land. So he called them. So the promised land is right over here. All they had to do is walk over here, right? And what'd God do? Took him across the sea, clear down the bottom of Sinai, and clear back up. Why did he do that? I mean, and that is some nasty country. I mean, that is... There's not even my kid's favorite sagebrush there, you know, doing it. You know, that's a desert with no life in it. My kids think they don't like sagebrush. They'll grow up someday. I like sagebrush. But he took them across. Remember the first thing they did? He called them out, and the Egyptians sent them out with their blessing, I believe, thinking, and Moses said, let my people go. Let us go out in the desert and worship our God. And so they gave them their gold and all their things to go worship their God, right? And their blessing, and then went, what if they don't come back? I mean, this is our labor force, and they took all our riches, man. And so Pharaoh got his guys together and chased them down, right? And came to the Red Sea, and I mean, that was the first thing, you know, and it's important to see. I mean, it is the picture of God calling us out of the world. God calling us to leave the world. In that process, again, God didn't just take the easy way. Yeah, say the prayer, you'll be in the promised land, land flowing with milk and honey, life's all good. Is that what happened? No. He said, you don't know me. You don't know my character. You don't know my nature. You don't know who I am. So you know what? I'm going to take you out in the desert and show you this. Show you who I am so that you will fear me. How does God, what is it about God that he wants to show them right off the get-go? I mean, they're at the parting of the sea. They're at this ocean, this giant body of water, and here's 1.5 million plus people and all their stuff stacked up against the water, and here comes the army of Pharaoh, who has been their slave masters for centuries, for 400 years. They're terrified. They hold authority over them. They hold mentally and physically and in every other way, they hold authority over them. And here's all these guys stacked up against her going, why did you bring us out here to be died? They're going to beat us now. This is not going to go well. And God opened up part of the Red Sea and they walked across on dry land and they're on the other side and here comes the Egyptians, right? And again, it's always never ceased to amaze me. I mean, growing up, the Bible culture, the stories of the Bible were much more integrated in everyday life when I was a kid. You know, you heard about them, you know, and the world and science begin to mock them, right? They begin to mock creation. They begin to mock, you know, we did have the chart on our wall in elementary school of monkey to man. Okay? I mean, it was there. They begin to mock the Bible in doing it. And they did this event that happened in the parting of the Red Sea. They said, well, it was the parting of the Reed Sea. And it was really only this deep, you know. It was just a real shallow sea. And that's how they got, the wind blew a little, they went across, you know. And that's how it happened. It wasn't a big deal. And I thought, it killed all of Pharaoh's army and their horses and everybody else, you know. So maybe that's even a bigger deal, you know, if they died in 16 inches of water, you know, or something. I mean, it's just, but it's a miraculous thing that God did here. And what is God teaching them about who he is? And so this, then Moses and the children of Israel sang this song to the Lord and spoke, saying, this is Exodus 15. I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and its rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song. He has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will praise him. My father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is a warrior. The Lord is his name. That's what God wanted to teach him. That's a pretty big deal. That's not the God we necessarily preach in church these days, right? He's a warrior. This is the first lessons that he's teaching them. He brings them out of Egypt, that they would understand this right from the get-go. Because what did he say? I took you so that you would see my might and my power and you would fear me. That's what he says. I took you out in the desert. I took you to Sinai, you know, so that when you came to the point in your life, just like all of us, when you came to that point in your life where God says, okay, are you going to give up your life and trust me? You're going to base it on what God? You're going to base it on what understanding of God? Is he trustworthy? Is he powerful? Is he able to fight for you? Can I trust? Because the enemy, every one of us, as children, the enemy lied to us and told us God is not trustworthy. God is not trustworthy. Look what happened to me. God's not trustworthy. Where was God when this happened? God's not trustworthy. God didn't do what I asked him to do. God's not trustworthy. God is not to be feared. God is not to be submitted. I can do what kind of I want. It's nice if I do follow him because that's a good religious way. But complete submission to his authority because I fear him, because I trust him, because I know that he is trustworthy, because my God is a warrior and master is his name. And all of us come to that point where we come to the Jordan River in our lives and God says, okay, I promised you that you can come into the land flowing with milk and honey, that you can know joy and peace, that you can be born again, that you can be set free from the power of sin. What does it mean? Lay your life down. Lay your life down right here. Cross this raging, flooding river and then go fight against fortified cities that are full of giants and warriors and people armored up and ready to go and go. And I will deliver you. How did most of the people respond? Based on the character and nature of God? No. I would say most people responded the same way most people still respond when God brings you to that point in your life. Nope. I want to go back to Egypt, man. I want to go eat leeks and onions by the Nile. I don't want to do this. That costs too much. That's too risky. I don't want to give up my control. I want to give up my life. I'm scared. I don't trust you. And most people don't enter the promised land. No different. And I would contend it's because we lie to him. Do we sing him this song and say, this is the God you serve. This is the God that you're going to serve. This is the God that you're going to lie. He's a warrior. and the Lord is his name. David understood that. This isn't just then. It's in the New Testament too, where he talks about the character and nature of God. Verse 17, he sent from above. He took me. He drew me out of many waters. He delivered me from my strong enemy, from those who hated me, from those who were too strong for me. They confronted me in the day of my calamity, but the Lord was my support. And he brought me out into a broad place, and he delivered me because he delighted in me. That's a powerful, very important thing. This, it's amazing. The more I read it, and the more I, you know, for some reason, man, I have a hard time getting through it in one setting, all 51 verses, you know, doing it. I just go there and go someplace else and read it, and, you know, in my head and in the Bible and doing it. But as I push through it and push through it and push through it, and I push through it several times at this point doing it, it's the New Testament gospel. It's the same God. It is not a different God. This is the same God. And it, in David's perspective on him, perspective of him is the same as we should have. So don't write it off. When we're troubled by David's perspective here, we should be troubled by the fact of, he was called a man after God's own heart. Maybe my perspective's wrong. Maybe it doesn't look right to me or seem right to me, because David's perspective wasn't, we don't have any indication it was wrong. God preserved this, put it in Psalm 18 for them to sing at the temple. It's a temple song, it's a worship of him. So obviously God thought this was pretty right on. This was a pretty right on perspective. Where it doesn't match ours, we should be troubled about our perspective, not David's. Okay? And we should struggle to understand what it looks like. And it's been sweet. The more I read it, the more I see the New Testament gospel in it. The New Testament gospel revealed in it. He delivered me because he delighted in me. And the words aren't the same, because we've got all these cute little phrases to feign humility, right? Oh, it's nothing I did. It's everything God did. There's nothing I can do. I mean, we've got all this little speak talk to try to seem humble in our relationship with God, because then somehow God's going to buy it. You know, that we can fake God out. We can be religious. We can adorn ourselves. We can do whatever we do with what we do and what we don't do, what we say, what we don't say. And it'll look good, and God will buy the fact that I'm a pious individual and I'll be good with him. God looks at our heart. The heart of David here was a man after his heart. God said that. That is true. It's no different than what it said. The truth is, he delivered me because he delighted in me. It's by grace. It's by the unmerited favor of God. God's acceptance of us, God's love towards us, is not based on my goodness. It's based on his character, on who he is. That his love is overwhelming and absolute and infinite. And based on his character and his love towards us, we can be right with him. That he delivered us because of his character, because he delighted in me. That is so critical for us to understand. It's not because I earned it. You know? All of us on some level grew up. There's ways to affect behavior in children and modify behavior in children. The most common one used by parents is rejection. Well, I would never reject my kid. Baloney. If you're a parent, you've used it. Because it's the easiest one that will affect character. Okay? We turn away from our kids, or go stand in the corner. Go stand in the corner until you can start acting nice. And when you start acting nice, then we can have a good relationship. When you're not acting nice, then I reject you. Oh, well, that's a very effective thing. What do you mean? Standing in the corner is a good thing. No, it's not. Why? It says, I'm going to reject you as long as you're acting bad. And if you act good, then I will accept you. Does that cause a child to modify his behavior? Absolutely. There is few things in this world that will modify a child's behavior like rejection. Okay? On whatever, we can go on and on and on about that. But rejection is, and it takes on all kinds of subtle forms in doing that we do. You know, if you're good, I'll be nice. If you're not, I won't be nice. If you're, you know, I'll pay attention, I'll do things. We use rejection because a child has this desperate need for the security and love of his parents, of the people that God has put in his life. And so a child will modify his behavior to get that. The problem is, you create a hard heart. You will create a hard heart. And all of us, on some level, have had a hard heart created in us because of our parents doing that. And we do that in our children. It is the most common, today, in these days, because parents have no idea why they're even doing what they're doing. And what does the Bible say? It says spank them. That is not rejecting you. That is not pushing you away. That is intervening in their life, staying very connected, staying very in their face. I do not reject you. I am going to discipline you for bad behavior. Not push you away. Not say I will love you when you're good. That's the hard thing to do. That's a tough thing for a parent to do. But the love of a parent that says, my love for you isn't based on whether you're good or bad. Isn't based on your performance. Isn't based on how you act. My love for you is absolute. Now, how you act will determine how I respond towards you. But it will never have to do with lack of love. It will never have to do with lack of response. It will never have to do with rejection or pushing away. Teaching a child that my love is not based, my love is unconditional and not based on your performance, is critical. And most of us fail as parents in doing that, and we're failed as parents in doing that, as children in doing that. But that is essential. God's love is infinite and not based. Unmerited favor towards us. That's what grace is. The Lord, now this little section, we talked about it, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time here. We did last week, the next section, because it's difficult for us to understand. Okay? Is this because of our sense of false humility? Because the way that we've learned Christianese and how we speak. You know, again, I hate the term. I'm just a sinner. I mean, one of the greatest lies, tragic lies, and it just angers me, is the only difference between me and people on the street that don't know God is I'm forgiven and they're not. That's the only difference. I'm no better than them. I'm no different than them. I'm no more deserving than them. You know, there's a fair amount of half-truths in there that are just about enough to speak direct lies from the pit of hell. If there is no distinction between me and somebody on the street, the only difference is I'm forgiven and they're not forgiven. So if you just accept God's forgiveness, now we're all good on doing it. The enemy is really good about going in that process, in that false understanding. The enemy is very good about going, yeah, you know, you're just a loser. You are just a sinner. You can't help it. That's just your flesh. That's just the way you are. That's just who makes you up. You're just like that. Whatever lies he's going to tell us. Whatever lies he's going to tell us on doing that. What are we to be? Well, the New Testament version would be in 1 John 14:21. It says, the one who has my commandments and keeps them, he it is who loves me. We say, I love God. If I love God, I'm just a spoiled, rotten little kid. No. The one who has my commandments and keeps them, that's the one who loves me. And the one who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him, and I will disclose myself to him. Wait. How does that work? There's obedience has something to do with appropriating the practical reality of God's love in our life? What it says, the one who has my commandments and keeps them, that's the one who loves me. And the one who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him, and I will reveal myself to him. You want to know God? Submit to his authority. Be obedient to who he is. What will that look like? Will that look like I'm a perfect person? My stool's a little higher so I can see you guys, but I don't sit on any high ground here, you know? And I would contend even to the effect of I'm in a process again right now of God going, you got issues, David, you need to deal with. Dang it. You know, I thought things were going pretty, no, there's issues, major issues in your life you need to deal with. Well, how can you wait until now to show me? Well, because you wouldn't deal with them before, I guess. It always is that process of sanctification and holiness. God commands us to be holy as he is holy. And let me tell you, that's a long ways. That is not elevated in the church on a level that people think of you as such a holy and righteous person. That is not fitting into the conformity of what religious people say is holy and righteous. That is being like God is, and that will look different. In fact, it will be hated by the religious world because it will look so different. The religious world will hate you if you look just like they did Jesus. And still, it's the same. And we're so, you know, they were much more biblically literate in Jesus' day and much more devout as a people. And they hated Jesus. So who do we think we are? And Jesus said, they hated me. So if they hated me, who has never sinned, who do you think you are to think they're not going to hate you? And he was not talking about the pagans. He was talking about those who claim to be pursuing God. The enemies of Jesus were not the pagans. They were not the, quote, sinners. They were not the people who didn't know God. The enemies of Jesus were the people who claimed to know God and were diligently and disciplined in pursuit of God. So to conform our lives to what the world says, the religious world says, is good and bad and righteous and not righteous and holy and unrighteous is a pretty scary postulate. Didn't work for them. Won't work for us. So David is standing on the goodness of God. My righteousness, what is my only hope to stand before God? Do I stand before God on my righteousness? It's a good thing I don't. And I don't. Do I have a right relationship with my Father based on my goodness? I don't. Based on what I've earned, based on me being good enough, I don't. I stand before my Father because I deserve death and he killed Jesus in my place. Because my wrong actions and my sin is atoned for by the blood of Jesus. We have this perception again of, this wrong perception. Well, as soon as I say the prayer, God doesn't see my sin anymore. Really? You think that is ridiculous to think God is blind? God put your sin on Jesus. God put your sin on Jesus and killed him because of your sin. He's not blind to it. He's not blind to it. And because he is a just God and a righteous God, and the wages of sin is death. He effected that in Jesus. And now I can stand because my sin is atoned for. My sin, the price has been paid, not by me, but by Jesus, by God himself. I can stand before God in the righteousness of Jesus. So when David is saying, the Lord rewarded me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanliness of my hands, he recompensed me. For I have kept the ways of the Lord and have not acted wickedly. In 1 John 14:21, Jesus himself said, the one who has my commandments and keeps them, that's the one who loves me. Not the one who says he loves me. Not the one who says wears the Jesus shirt and the cross and does all the outward things. The person who has his commandments and keeps them. Why? Because acknowledging God for God means submission, means calling him Lord. We do not get to have a right relationship with God without calling him Lord, and Lord means master. Master. And it isn't a matter of using the word Lord. It's a matter of having that determine who I am, is that I see God as my master. For I have kept the ways of the Lord and not acted wickedly and not wickedly departed from my God. For all his judgments were before me. As for his statutes, I did not depart from them. We know that David sinned. That's not the issue. The issue is that he had a soft and a broken and contrite heart and was repented. He agreed with God about his sin. Remember, by the time he was confronted by the prophet Nathan about Bathsheba. He was broken. Okay? He acknowledged his sin and saw that. And what did Nathan say? Your sin's forgiven you. Not that Nathan was there to forgive sin. That's the work of Jesus. And it was then and it is now. Still was. His sin was forgiven. Why? Because of the atoning work of Jesus on the cross, man. Then and now. So he was could be blameless before him. And I kept myself from iniquity. Therefore the Lord has recompensed me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanliness of my cleanliness in his eyes. With the merciful you will show yourself merciful. With the blameless man you will show yourself blameless. With the pure you will show yourself pure. With the devious you will show yourself shrewd. You will save the humble people, but your eyes are on the haughty, that you may bring them down. You are my lamp, O God. The Lord shall enlighten my darkness. For by you I can run against a troop. By you I can leap over a wall. As for God, he is perfect. The word of the Lord is proven. He is a shield to all who trust in him. For who is God except the Lord? Who is a rock except our God? God is my strength and my power, and he makes my way perfect. He makes my feet like the feet of deer and sets me on high places. He teaches my hands to make war so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze. You have also given me the shield of your salvation. Your gentleness has made me great. You enlarged my path under me, so that my feet did not slip. I have pursued my enemies and destroyed them. Again, this is relevant to our lives today. I have pursued my enemies and destroyed them. Who does that mean? What does that look like? What is that about? Neither did I turn back till they were destroyed. And I have destroyed them and wounded them so that they could not rise. They have fallen under my feet. For you have armed me with strength for the battle. You have subdued under me those who rose against me. You have given me the necks of my enemies so I can destroy those who hated me. They looked, but there was none to save. Even so the Lord, even to the Lord they called out, but he did not answer them. For I beat them as fine as the dust of the earth. And I trod them like dirt in the streets. And I spread them out. Wow. What does that have to do with it? That is not. What does it say in Ephesians? For our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and rulers of this dark age, right? Let me read another place, because the New Testament is full of it, if you look for it. There is still a war going on. There is still a battle going on, but it is a different realm. Right? 2 Corinthians 10. Let's see. Verse 3, it says, for though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare, we do war. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, are not fleshly, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds. Casting down, what are strongholds? Let me guarantee you, and those of you who know me, with spend any time, you know that I talked to you about it, about this, because I believe it's, our fight is still on. Okay? The enemy has worked. My short story, the short version is, the enemy works very strong at a young age to build strongholds in us. And if he can build those strongholds in our lives, he can pretty much walk away. Because they will assure our destruction. The tragic part is that most of us regard those strongholds in our life as our points of strength and our points of safety and our refuge. What protects us? What defends us? Where we can go to in need? So we don't even want to tear them down. We don't even want to destroy them. And yet we are in a battle. We are in a war. No different than what David's talking about here. The Lord is, what is our enemies? Who are our enemies? The enemy occupies those strongholds. We think they're our point of refuge. We think they're our point of safety. What are they? It says, the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, not fleshly, not swords, not shields, not spears, not bows of bronze. Right? They're not. But mighty in God for pulling down strongholds. What does that mean? Casting down arguments and every high thing that exists, that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. Bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. That is a very, very powerful 2 Corinthians 10 that all of us should meditate on. Because that's the fight. That is a very good description of the fight. We all, arguments, reasoning, the word that's used there is, the baseline is logic, right? It's logistica something. I forget exactly the word now, pardon me, I didn't bring it written down. But I was looking up the Greek word on it, and the word used there for arguments, some of them say speculations. I don't know, will your Bibles use a different word? I'm reading out of this one because it happens to be handy. It's not the one I normally do. Mine says speculations. What's that? 2 Corinthians 10. Okay? The arguments, they are things, they are lie. If the enemy can get us to believe a lie, he's got us, right? So he does that, and he works on that, and he works on that hard. One of the lies that he puts in us, one of the speculations, one of the arguments that he puts in us, is I can't really trust God, but I can trust myself. I'm not sure that God is really paying attention, so I better take care and I better pay attention to my needs and make sure those needs are met. That God is not one of the ingrained, even though we wouldn't say it with our mouth. There's probably no one in here that if I said, If I ask the question, do you believe God's trustworthy? Everybody would probably raise their hand. Well, of course God is trustworthy, right? That is not the way we live our lives. Okay? Do you believe God's untrustworthy? Oh, no. You can't say that. That would be blasphemous. And yet we live our lives, I don't trust. What does it mean we don't trust God? Well, if he says to do this, but I can't trust him that that's the best way to do it, so I'm going to do this. He says that he will be my defender and protector. He says that we are to be gentle and kind and not respond in anger. He says that he is the one that will judge all wrong. Nope, I don't believe God can do that. I need to. I need to get in the middle of this and take care of it because God isn't going to do that for me. I mean, that the enemy builds up strongholds in us, thoughts about God, right? Not things that come up against arguments and every high thing, every view of God, right? Every view of God that goes against the true knowledge of God. God doesn't hear me. God isn't round. I don't know if God will hear me or not. I haven't been good enough, right? It's a good one. Guilt and shame is a big one that God puts on you. I don't deserve God's favor, so I guess I better get after it because he's not going to take care of it because I don't deserve it. Whatever the lies are, if the enemy can get you to believe things that are not true about God, if he can ingrain those in you and get you to believe things that are not true about God, so many of those are based on your dad's failing you. And your view of God is tainted because dad was selfish. Because dad did think of his own interests above yours at times. Because dad did strike out in anger. Because dad wasn't trustworthy. Those attributes go to God. Those attributes go to that stronghold, and you build a stronghold to self-defend, to protect yourself as a child, as a young person, and that forms your character and shapes your character. And he says that now we have a fight. Now we have an enemy who will reinforce and strengthen that stronghold. And as you say, he says it comes against those things. What does he say? Casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captive. Bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. There's a fight, man. Every thought. What do you mean every thought? Well, the thought that says, ugh, I'm going to strike out at you and hurt you because I need to do that to defend myself. Of course, most of the fact that, well, I'm in a tough situation, but I can't trust God. I need to do this. I need to take charge of this. That's a thought that goes contrary to a true knowledge of God. Taking every thought captive. That's the fight. So you listen to David over here, and he's warring, man. He's fighting, right? He's saying, God is my strength, right? He makes me strong. He gives me all this. What does the New Testament say? God has equipped us. God has given us every good thing. When Jesus died on the cross, he broke the bondage of the enemy over us. Okay? So, what is that? Now, one of the lies most of us believe is that's not true. I can't help myself. This is just the way I am. This is the way I feel. The way you feel and what is true about God are often quite contrary. And which one's right? The truth about God. Not the way you feel. Which one do we let determine us? Too often the way we feel. Not the truth about God and who God is. That's the fight. That's the thing that we are to fight against. Jesus died on the cross to set us free from the bondage of sin, from the power of Satan, and we can be out from it. How do we do that? By acknowledging him as Lord and submitting to him as our master. Earn his favor? No. God's love is absolute. But we don't appropriate the power of God in our lives when we're giving him the middle finger. We appropriate the power of God and all the blessings of happiness and joy and peace and contentment when we're submissive to his authority. And outside, no different than a child, right? What is the response when a child is disobedient and rebellious? Does he get to know the blessings of a right relationship with his parents and joy and happiness and peace and contentment and security and safety? Or does he get a spanking? Correct parenting would say he gets a spanking, right? He doesn't know those blessings. He doesn't know the joy of it. And it says, and all good dads will discipline their parents, and discipline their children. And the truth is, if we are not, it says to the extent in John, if we do not look like we are getting spanked by our dad, then we should question who our dad is. We are illegitimate children, it says, because the legitimate children of God the Father, he will spank and discipline because that will take that until the day we die. You know, it varies. I don't stay in a constant state of getting my butt beat, but Kind of getting it right now. Kind of getting it right now, getting spanked. And that's, you know, there's a side of me that fortunately I am confident enough in the character and nature of God to know, God, I hate this, I don't like it, but thank you. You know, the end result will be better. And what I want more than anything is to reconcile with you and to be right with God through my disobedience. Outside of my disobedience. You have delivered me from the strivings of my people. You have kept me as the head of the nations. A people I have not known shall serve me. The foreigners submit to me. As soon as they hear, they obey me. The foreigners fade away and come frightened from their hideouts. The Lord lives. Blessed be my rock. Let God be exalted, the rock of my salvation. It is God who avenges me and subdues the people under me. He delivers me from my enemies. You also lift me up above those who rise against me. You have delivered me from the violent man. Therefore, I will give thanks to you, O God, among the Gentiles and sing praises to your name. He is a tower of salvation to his king. He shows mercy to his anointed, to David and his descendants forevermore. You know, I wish that I could force you all to read that about 10 or 20 times. I can't. So, but I wish I could. Because the effect, I know on myself is powerful, and the ability to see it from a different perspective rather than just, again, the way it's written in poetry. You know, David wrote it that way, so it doesn't, when we translate it into English from Hebrew, it doesn't necessarily flow all that pretty. The way it expresses and the language that it uses are a struggle at times. But it is a right heart towards God. And if our heart does not align ourselves with the truth of this, not by our initial brief read it over once interpretation, but if our heart does not align with David's heart, we do not have a heart after God. Our view of God is not correct. To me, it's been a sweet one to be challenged. Again, the first time reading, I go, gosh, can't we skip this? I could probably hide under the fact, well, this is in Psalm 18. You guys ought to read it. It's a cool psalm. Let's just move on to 23, you know, and talk about something else. I mean, I was literally tempted going, I don't want to deal with that, man. Why did he write the things he wrote? And the more that I read it, and the more that I spent time, the more I realized, because that is the heart that we are to have towards our God. And it expresses that. And my heart, my understanding, wrong understanding of how my heart should look and how I should feel towards God is the issue, not David's. So, be challenged. David wasn't a fool that didn't understand, you know, how cloud structure happened and how lightning came and what thunder was. Didn't understand wind and didn't understand, you know, the power that God has put in nature. No, David was not. David just understood the character and nature of God and the power that's there. And David understood the battle that we're to fight, and we have to. Our God is a warrior. That is a basic fundamental understanding that God needed to show his people after 400 years of being in captivity. And they needed a correction. They needed a lot of correction on their view of Yahweh, this God of our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. What was one of the first corrections? Our God is a warrior. Okay? What does that mean to us today? Is that the God I serve? Is that the God that I submit to? Is that the God that I claim to know? Or is he just kind of my sugar daddy that I call on when I need and hope he can help me out a little bit, and if not, I'll take care of it. God, don't worry about it. I got it. So we act on some level, right? Do we understand, are we willing to see the nature and the character of God and what he's made in, what he's made in the wind? It's always amazing to me. I'm not a fan of wind. You know, part of it is I'm a hunter.
Animals don't like wind. I don't like wind. Animals lay low when it's windy. The wind swirls and blows my scent towards them, blows up my stock. Dang it, I don't like wind. You know? The Spirit of God is pictured as the wind. And, you know, God could have chosen a lot of things, I guess, you know. Spirit of God should be seen as the scent of a wildflower. Didn't say that. So, take the things that God has made and be challenged by them. Be challenged by David's view of God. You know, what is my righteousness? Where do I stand before God? You know? One of the greatest, sweetest things about correct discipline of a child is a child's ability to reconcile with his parents. And he can stand before his parents and go, we're all good now, right? We're good now. You know? Not because I snuck and got away with it. When a kid sneaks and get away with it, or when a parent doesn't pay attention, or a parent doesn't follow through with what he says, do you realize what a burden you put on your kid? Do you realize what a weight you put on them? Because they're not right with you, man. And they can pretend like the kids are really good. They'll be the best right then, right? Oh, well, what can I do for you, Mom and Dad? Oh, aren't we good now? Because of this desperate need to be right within you. But the truth is that after they've been reconciled, after you said, if you do this, this is what's going to happen. This is what happens. They get a spanking for what they've done. And now we're good, Dad, right? Now we're good. We can stand in that thing of, now we're good, Dad. Jesus took the spanking for me, man. And I can stand in that. You know, if a child goes, I got a spanking, now I paid for that, right? Forget you, I'm leaving, I'm out of here. Obviously, that isn't good, right? No different than us with God. I know Jesus died for my sins, okay, Jesus died for me, but now I'm going to do what I want. Does that mean we're reconciled with our dad? Obviously not reconciled with our dad. The response would be a broken and contrite heart. This, like, correct discipline will produce a broken and contrite heart. I would contend that oftentimes provoking a child to anger is stopping about one spanking too little. Don't turn me into child protection agency, whatever thing. I am suggesting you beat your kids, but in a right way, in a correct way. But if at the end of a spanking, a child is not broken and contrite in heart and wants nothing more than be reconciled and right with their parents, you failed. You've provoked your child to anger. Let's pray. Your grace is enough. Your grace is enough. Your unmerited favor towards us. Your unmerited favor towards us isn't overlooking our sin. Your unmerited favor towards us is that you put what was due me, the spanking, the death, on Jesus. And he took it for me. And you say, well, what's that have to do with it? That should produce in me a humble and broken and contrite heart. If it does not, I do not recognize what Jesus did. Not, oh, I got away with that. But he substitutionarily took what was due me, should bring submission and gratefulness and gratitude and recognition of the magnitude of your love and your desire to have a relationship with me. Not, I got away with it. God, I thank you that you were willing to write the Old Testament and not just let us have a few books in the New Testament that we could interpret according to our cultural God. I thank you that you wrote the Old Testament to keep it there to blow away our idolatry, Because man has always done that. Man has always created an image in his, of you in his own image. And how we think you should look and how we think we should act, you should act. And I thank you for giving us the Old Testament as a constant battering ram of our idolatry in our boxes. To knock them down, to destroy them. Please do that, God. We all have wrong images of you that cause wrong behavior and wrong response and lack of holiness. So please battering ram those things down. Please cause us to be willing to be confused and struggle and strive to understand what you mean, what David means, what it looks like to have a broken and contrite heart correct before you. We look at David and go, why you're awful forgetful, David. You were a bad boy. Cause us to understand what forgiveness is, that he understood forgiveness, that he could not pay for his sin. His response after Nathan came and said, you are forgiven of God, but your child will die. And he fasted and he prayed and he cried out to God. And when his child died, he went to the temple and worshiped. And his response was correct towards your mercy and your forgiveness and your love and your authority as God. Not thinking that we could pay for our sins by our guilt and our shame and our self-mastication. You've paid the price. Your grace is enough. And I thank you for that. Cause us to live with gratitude towards you. Cause us to realize that we have a price that cannot be repaid. That we've been bought with a price. Our lives are not our own. And if we're going to obtain the unmeasurable value of forgiveness through Jesus, we die to ourselves and to our flesh. That's how we identify and are baptized and fully immersed into the death and resurrection of Jesus. And to realize, to act any difference to mean we don't realize what you did. And who you are. Shake us, God. Shake us till we align with you. In the name of Jesus, amen.